Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. We have a powerful and power-packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be speaking to the oppression of women that is so much a major part of this mind and body eating system that we live under. And opening the show up, we're going to be doing a segment on the recent police murders of Stephon Clark, who was murdered by the police in Sacramento while he was standing in his grandmother's backyard, and Willie McCoy, who was murdered by the police while he was asleep in a Vallejo, California Taco Bell. The system says that these outrageous murders are justified. We'll be listening to a few clips from talks by Bob Avakian speaking to the real character of these and other heinous police murders, murders that have been a part of this system since the moment this country was founded. The first talk is, Yes, There Is a Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off, taken from a talk by Bob Avakian called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And the second is Police Murder and the Murderous Logic of This System's Election Game. And that's from Revolution and Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. You can listen to both of these talks in their entirety by going to the Bob Avakian section of revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us. So opening the show up is a discussion I had back in October of 2015 with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Nicholas Hayward, one of the initiators of the Stolen Lives Project, which documents the bitter reality of how police across the country killed more than 2,000 people in the 1990s alone, most of them black or Latino, most of them young, and many of them unarmed and doing nothing wrong when their lives were stolen by those who were sworn to protect and serve. Nicholas's son, Nicholas Jr., 13 years old, was murdered by the police for playing with a water pistol in the stairwell of the building he lived in. The cop who murdered him walked free. This conversation was originally broadcast as part of building for a powerful demonstration in New York City against police murder. I'm very pleased to welcome to the show someone that I've been following for a long time because of the work that he has done and because of who he is and what he's doing. His name is Nicholas Hayward Sr. He's the father of Nicholas Hayward Jr., who was murdered, as Nicholas has always been very clear about pointing out. He was murdered at the hands of the Housing Authority police here in New York City, and he has been fighting for justice around that, both around his son's case, but also around police murder across the board, all right? And he's been fearless out there and courageous out there, and this is not an easy vocation to take up, but it's a necessary one, and it's one that he does with a lot of passion. Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Honored to be here, sir.
Let's jump into what we should be talking about here now. I want people to know your story. What happened to Nicholas Hayward Jr.?
Nicholas was murdered by NYPD Housing Police Officer Brian George on September 27, 1994. Nicholas and a couple of his friends, aging in the range of 11 to 14, were playing innocent game of cops and robbers. They had plastic toy guns. Mind you, none of them looked at anything close to a real weapon. Yet, the district attorney, Charles Hines, chose to close the case without presenting it to a grand jury, stating that the weapon that Nicholas had, which was a plastic cork pop gun, orange tip, orange handle, and he basically said that the officer was on a 911 call, stereo lighting dim, things happened in a split second, and he called it an accidental misfire. He closed the case, never presented to the grand jury. In a deposition that was done on the officer, the officer stated that he was not responding to a 911 call. He was just doing basic routine patrol. He said that the stereo lighting was not dimly lit. He was able to see well. And he also said things didn't happen in a split second. His statement that he made to justify this killing, and mind you, this came, the deposition was done like 3 years after. He stated that when he opened the stereo door, there was no one there. Nicholas jumped down from the steps suddenly. He had his gun in one hand, and he said he had a flashlight in the other. He said then Nicholas jumped back up the steps, then jumped back down the steps, then turned and pointed the pop gun at him and started clicking it. He said he heard four clicks, and then he shot him.
You know, this is the thing. I mean, so just so people are clear, this cop, basically two completely different stories from what he was originally put out and then what he gave in that position 2 years after the murder, completely changes it. You know, you're telling your story, and I can't help but think, you know, one, how many times has this happened? And what we're seeing today, including with the Tamir Rice thing, where the stories get changed constantly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not only they, the Nicholas Naquan Hayward Jr. murder is the same identical story as the Akai Grawley case, which is prepared to go for trial in January. I mean, the exact. I mean, rookie cop. Both were rookie cops. Both supposed to be in this dark stairwell. Both shot like split second, and none of them were actually charged. Although the Kai Grawley case is going to trial, and I am hoping for a conviction, but after 20 years in this struggle and seeing injustice done in every single case nationally, I mean, I really can't see any justice being done in this case. Even if there is a conviction, what kind of sentencing would this officer wind up getting? There's just too many cases of innocent, unarmed victims that are being gunned down, and they are all being ruled justifiable homicide. The Akai Grawley case is an exception, and I feel a little fortunate right now due to the fact that the district attorney right now, Ken Thompson, has agreed to take another look into my son's case. And he's also the one who placed the indictment on the officer that murdered Akai Grawley. And I use the term murder, and people need to understand this also. When you shoot and kill an innocent, unarmed person who isn't committing any crimes, isn't a threat to the officer at all, that is murder. You're shooting an innocent, unarmed human being. It is no way to just say it was an accident or accidental misfire. These are supposed to be, you don't place these officers on the street to patrol communities without proper training. So you already gave them the training that they needed to come into these communities and supposedly serve and protect the communities. Although that is not what they're doing. They are actually out in the communities brutalizing, and there's a lot of brutality and murders that's going on in New York City and worldwide, and broken windows it definitely needs to be stopped. Mm-hmm.
Now tell me this, because when you're talking about the training, in some ways though, I tend to think sometimes, look, we got to look at this. And when you look back, I was thinking about this morning, Nicholas Jr. was killed 21 years ago, and how many thousands of people have been killed? I mean, we're talking about just a conservative estimate of 1,000 people a year killed by the police. And if you think about that, if that had been happening in any other country in the world, if that had been happening anywhere else, if that had been happening in any way, shape, or form, would people accept that 21,000 people that we know of? That's just what we know of. And, when you think about the training of the cops, because I was thinking about this with the Tamir Rice case, the training of the cops, and this is what came out in those reports, is they just said that, Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old child who was playing with a pop gun, very similar to Nicholas Jr.
Absolutely.
Who hadn't, and Tamir had it in his pant waist. He was in the waist of his pants, and he was just standing there.
Right.
And the cops pull up, and less than 2 seconds, they shoot him. And you have to wonder, they're not indicted. It goes to a grand jury. They send it out for these special reports that come from an FBI, a former FBI guy and a former prosecutor who say that the police are all, that's cool, that they were reasonable. What the hell does that mean, that they were reasonable?
That is actually unacceptable. And no one should accept that investigation because, like I said, in my experience over the last 20 years, I don't see any investigations. If there were investigations done in the murder of all of these innocent victims, we would see police being locked up and sent to jail. There is no investigation. These so-called FBI or community affairs, any and all of these government officials who call themselves investigating a situation of innocent, unarmed victims being gunned down and they justify it, then they need to be fired themselves, because that is not an investigation. You can't get an indictment on these officers or nothing. Since the murder of Nicholas Jr. in New York City, there's been over 374 innocent victims of police murder. That means that we right now have over 374 police in communities still patrolling who have murdered someone. But yet, they're still in these communities. They always try to blame a lot of this brutality and murder on the crime statistics in the communities. But they produce all of that crime. People are struggling in these poor communities. And yet, this system doesn't provide any kind of outlet for them. for the youth or anything. In my community, we have a center where the youth supposed to go to after school or, you know, to do positive things inside the community, inside a center that's provided in the community, but yet it's been closed for over 20 years. How do you justify that? Closing a community center for the youth and the seniors, how do you justify for 20 years? No access to, I mean, right now you go into the community, they're all sitting around on benches and, you know, nowhere to, like, access. I mean, what are they supposed to do? Stay in the house, don't do anything? Things like that, you know, the system actually creates the environment for violence and anger and struggle. And this is something that it just shouldn't be. It just shouldn't be that way.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And folks, this is a special show. It's all about Rise Up October. It's all about what I'm talking with Nicholas Hayward Sr. about in terms of stopping police brutality, stopping the murder, turning the stuff around, drawing a line, a dividing line. Which side are you on? That's the question that's posed to everybody. You know, you were talking about the training of the cops. And that's something that, you know, as I was saying, it seems to me very much so that their training is to be an occupying army. And to do whatever it takes to keep people down for whom this system has said, just as you're pointing to, that there is absolutely no way that the system can use people like that anymore. So you get mass incarceration, you get mass murder. You know, what do you think about that?
Well, I believe that's what they want. They want to basically, you look at mass incarceration in the prison industrial system, big money. It's more money being put into the jail system than it is to education and access for the youth and stuff like that. There, they are actually coming into these communities. They want these youth in prison because they generate more money if they're in prison opposed to opening up schools and stuff like that for these youth. So they want them there. This is the 20th anniversary of October 22nd coming up. 20 years we've been out here. For the last 20 years, fighting and struggling to put an end to actually stop police brutality and murder nationally.
Let me ask you this in relation to that, because you have been from the very beginning. I remember when October 22nd first started up, and you won't remember this, but I talked to you on the phone way back then, you know, and there was a reading of the names of the people that were killed by the police, you know, and there was that whole idea of really making that, you know, a nationwide battle. And you were among the first people to step up into this, and you're still fighting today. Let's talk about this. What was so important about October 22nd, way back when it started, as it went through the years, but also, what's happening today in relation to this and why that's so important?
It was important to me back then because October 22nd was one of the only groups that I've known of that was out there and wanted to put a complete end to police brutality. And it's a national movement that they have. October 22nd is happening in over 20 cities across the country. And I remember at one time it was happening over 55 cities across the country. But October 22nd is on the move. It's a national organization, and people need to get involved with that. The reason I stay involved in it is because things are escalating now. Police brutality and murder is escalating. It's not declining. And people need to understand that we need the people to put an end to this. That's why I've been here for the last 20 years. It pains me every time I hear of an innocent victim being killed, you know, senselessly by souls who's supposed to be, or who they claim or want us to believe are out here to serve and protect us. That is a complete lie. It's a lie, and people need to know that it's a lie. The police are not in our communities to protect us. And I see it every day. I mean, all over it's happening. And it just pains me so much, you know, to actually hear about, you know, all of these murders. And there's been 4 victims of police murder in my own community. In my own community, there's been over 4 murders in police brutality, police murder. And it don't trouble me because of the fact that I know why the police are there. You know, in my 20 years, I wasn't just sitting around just raising my voice, trying to get just justice for my son. I've been out there fighting with the parents, family members to put an end to this. The people need to come together. And also they need to realize also, this is the 20th anniversary of October 22nd. We are doing October 22nd right now. We have this Rise Up October. we have to learn that when things are still going and, you know, the same and there's actually no change and things are escalating, we got to change direction. We got to get out there in numbers and we have to make the change. We got to let the people know we have to prepare for this change, because this is something that, like I have been saying for the longest, I have children and I have grandchildren, and I do not wish for my children or my grandchildren to be out here in this struggle fighting for something that doesn't, I mean, we shouldn't even have to be going through this right here. We really shouldn't be. We shouldn't have to be fighting and struggling for equal rights or equal, you know, justice. We don't have any equal rights in this system. We don't have no justice under this system. This is too many names. I mean, it really is, you know. And it just, you know, it sickens me that we have to constantly be out here on a regular, everyday, you know, fighting and exposing this terror that's been sweeping this country for actually since we came to America.
Yeah, and people, black people did not come to America either. They was dragged here in chains at the bottom of the ship.
Absolutely.
And they created a bone highway across the ocean.
Right.
Killing many millions of people. Now, let me ask you this, Nicholas. Let me ask you this, because there is a very special project of Rise Up October that I was very moved by, and it's called the 100 Families Project.
Right.
Let's talk about that, because I imagine you're pretty much at the heart of a lot of that, too.
Yes, sir. The 100 Families Rise Up. We need to get as many. I'm hoping that we can get more than 100 families to come out to New York at Rise Up October 24th, because the reality is that we need the world to see all these families, and 100 families is just a few. Mind you.
And this is families of people who've been killed.
Absolutely. This is just a few, you know, a few of the families, because there's been thousands and thousands of innocent victims whose families and parents are suffering, you know, day in and day out. And we need the people to actually see these faces of the parents and the family members who are suffering, you know, because they haven't received any justice at all in any case. Every single case, this is what really sickens me about this system in this country. That every single case, you justify every single one. And that thing that they keep constantly saying, they feared for their life. We have coward cops all over the place, because that's where fear comes from. You got to be I walk anywhere, any city, any state, any country, unarmed. I don't fear for my life going into any community. I don't care whether they say it's a drug-ridden, crime-ridden community. I've been in almost all the communities. I'm 58 years old. I've been around. I don't fear for my life going into any of those communities. Why should a police who's armed with a weapon or it just is for them to use that as an excuse or a reason to justify shooting innocent babies, children, youth, adults, senior citizens? They use the reality of. That really isn't a reality. It's a made-up story that they're using to justify and to get these police off. And I ask myself, why do they always want to justify this? Why do you not want to have honest police on the streets who really protect and serve these communities? Why they don't want that? Because we never did have that. There are no police out here who really, you know, get to interact or really get to talk with the people in the community. I don't see that happen nowhere. And if we did, we wouldn't have these many names.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that's happening on the anniversary, on the day of the Stolen Lives Project, on the 22nd in Times Square, is going to be a reading of the names. What do you think is the importance of that, of people being there for that, a reading of these names, of saying no more, and people showing up to be at that reading?
They need to do all they can to actually try their best to make it to October 22nd, Times Square, for the reading of the names. It's important for people to hear the families and all those who are actually involved, who are out there to expose the reality. They need to see and hear this.
Nicholas Hayward Sr., father of Nicholas Hayward Jr., murdered 21 years ago by the Housing Authority cops in New York City. Nicholas, I have to tell you, I've waited a long time to talk with you, brother, and I don't want to have to wait that long again. And we will talk again. And you're a member of the club that nobody ever wanted to join. I think you put it that way once. And it's really important that people understand that they need to be standing with you and all of the other families and all of the other people who have been murdered and all of the people who are demanding that the humanity of Black and Latino people be respected, and that this stop now, that they take it, say, they pick a side that they're going to be on. Thank you very much for joining us today,
Absolutely.
Nicholas.
Absolutely.
All right. Joining me to talk about this right now is one of the, well, people who listen to my show regularly know him, and people who haven't listened to my show regularly are going to know him. His name is Carl Dix, and he's a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's also a co-founder with Cornell West of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And with Cornell, he issued the call for Rise Up October. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Now, you know, Carl, this is the first time that we've ever sat face-to-face on this show, this particular show.
That's true.
All right. Well, let's take advantage of it. Let's talk for a long time, man.
Okay.
I want to get into this. This, you know, every day we're looking at this stuff. But I want to talk to you about this because every day, it seems, we're seeing some new atrocity committed against the people. And sometimes it's, yes, every 28 hours a black person is killed by the police. At the same time, it seems like even more so, you're finding things that come up where something happens where the justifications, the exonerations, the forgiving of all this is being done, which adds insult to injury, which murders a person twice.
Yeah, well, see, there's a process that killings done by police go through, and it's a process of a whitewash. You know, you take it, even when you see it happen, when it's Eric Garner and you watched on TV as they choked him to death, or Tamir Rice, where you watch the video again and again, or even like Gilbert Flores in San Antonio, a young Latino man who was gunned down by police with his hands up, caught on video. He ran from them, decided he couldn't get away, stopped, turned around, put his hands in the air, and they shot him anyway. But there's a process that these kinds of killings go through, even when they're open and shut murder cases. To anybody with any kind of humanity and common sense, they collect information, they put it before the grand jury, and then they steer the grand jury in a way to engineer an exoneration for the murdering cops. And that's what's being done in Cleveland. And we got to say, we ain't having this no more. We're going to be saying that here in New York at Rise Up October. And coming out of Rise Up October, look, I'm going to be proposing that we carry this battle through. Because as I sat and listened to Nicholas, I was reflecting. Nicholas Hayward Jr., Tamir Rice, Andy Lopez, John Crawford, Black and Latino people who were gunned down having toy guns. And it's like people say, well, I even heard people commenting around this case. Well, they should stop pointing those toy guns at the cops. In none of those cases did they point the toy gun at the cops. They just had a toy gun. And it's like you can't have a toy gun if you're Black or Latino. And it basically brings us back to Dred Scott, the 1857 Supreme Court case that said that Black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. Well, that's the approach that the criminal injustice system in this country takes. Black people, brown people have no rights that must be respected by this criminal injustice system. And we have to actually strip the legitimacy off of that system, show that it is illegitimate at its heart and that it needs to stop. And it also brought to mind a quote that Bob Avakian recently did. Coming off of the massacre in Charleston, but also in general, what's been going on in this country. And here's the quote. I wanted to read that for the listeners. There is the potential for something of unprecedented beauty to arise out of unspeakable ugliness. Black people playing a crucial role in putting an end at long last to this system, which has for so long not just exploited, but dehumanized, terrorized, and tormented them in a thousand ways, putting an end to this in the only way it can be done, by fighting to emancipate humanity, to put an end to the long night in which human society has been divided into masters and slaves, and the masses of humanity have been lashed, beaten, raped, slaughtered, shackled, and shrouded in ignorance and misery. And see, that captures it, because unspeakable horrors are being committed against the people. But out of these horrors, there have been people, you know, people like Nicholas Hayward, like Tamir Rice's mother, like Alice Howell in Zion, Illinois, all of them parents, and in some cases grandparents, of people murdered by the police, who have, in the face of that unspeakable horror and the great loss, stood up and become fighters, not just for their murdered loved ones, but fighters against all this injustice. And that is what gives the basis and the potential for bringing some great beauty out of this by ending this. And Rise Up October's got a lot of different people who come at this a lot of different ways, religious people of different faiths and denominations, young people who are horrified by the injustice, family members who are motivated by trying to deal with their loss. But it also has people like me, revolutionary communists. And look, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end this once and for all. And I encourage people to get into the strategy for revolution, the leadership we have, and to go to the website revcom.us.
Sisters and brothers, this is Michael Slade, and I've just been talking with Carl Dix. And I want to thank Carl Dix for being on the show today. I also want to thank Nicholas Hayward Sr. for being on the show.
All right, now we have time for one more thing, and it's an important thing. This is a clip entitled, Yes, There's a Conspiracy to Get the Cops Off. And it's from Bob Avakian's speech, Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. It's a speech given in 2003 by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And you can access this entire speech at revolutiontalk.net. But this particular aspect of it seems to be particularly fitting, especially after our discussion of Tamir Rice and all the others.
Think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police, how you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He'd talk about a black man gets pulled over by the police and he has to say, I am reaching into my pocket for my license because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident. You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts whale? This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely, and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up. They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty. Well, they should have found him guilty anyway, but you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Look what happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in LA. They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes into court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Whenever anything happens, we're told, well, the problem is we got to vote. Michael Brown is shot down in cold blood. Yes, he was shot down in cold blood in Ferguson. Well, we need to get more black elected officials. I thought you already had a black president. How many more black elected officials can you possibly have? What did the black president do? Nothing. Not because he's an Uncle Tom, but because he is a part of, he is the chief executive and commander-in-chief of the system that has to shoot down the Michael Brown. Listen to the police and what they tell you. Well, if officer, notice how respectfully he's treated, Officer Wilson. He's a thug, a murderer, Officer Wilson. Well, if Officer Wilson is indicted, that's going to make it very difficult for police officers in these difficult situations where their life is on the line. What? Let's translate that into real terms. What they're saying is, if we can't go out and shoot down these youth in cold blood over and over again, we cannot and will not do our job. Because that is their job. And let me ask you this. If that is not their job, then why do they do it over and over and over and over again? And why are they never punished for doing it over and over and over again? Because this is what this system needs them to do. Because it has a whole section of people in the inner cities that it can't even profitably exploit anymore. So it treats them as so much human garbage. Instead of being able to and moving to provide them with work and a decent life, it pins them in the ghettos, encourages them to kill each other, and then kills them on top of all that.
Cats like me and you have got lost. They adhere to laws outside the laws as they down by those we don't subscribe to. The world is getting stranger. Bring on the revolution. I wanna die for something. Bring on the revolution.
Welcome back. That was Revolution by the Pretenders. Since this is March, a month where the oppression of women is spoken to front and center as part of fighting to end it, we're going to listen to two clips from Bob Avakian on the subject. The first is The Oppression of Women and Oppressive Gender Relations, and that will be followed by Why Does Private Ownership of the Means of Production Result in the Oppression of Women? But first, we're going to listen to a poem by Narges Kestu called Womanhood.
I'm very happy to welcome my next guest to the show. She is Narges Kestu, a young poet, and she's here to read a refreshingly defiant poem on the oppression of women around the world. And this is a person who some friends of mine bumped into you as when you came into Revolution Books.
Yeah.
And you said, I have a poem. And you said it's on YouTube, and they checked it out, and it was, wow, what a great poem.
Thank you.
And it's Narges Kestu, and I want you to jump.
Kestu.
I knew I'd get the pronunciation wrong, but I'll get it right next time. Kestu.
Okay.
Narges, this is a poem about the oppression of women. It's for International Women's Day.
Yeah.
For, okay.
Spread by women in general.
Okay. Okay. Go to it.
Here we go. I am woman. Hear me roar! With a voice too loud to ignore. Coming with stories never heard before. We deserve respect of this, I'm sure. In a little while, you'll realize our strength is hardcore. Society deems women emotional, unstable, and inferior. They never praise their insides or base their worth on their interior. Well, we're here to let you know we are more than just our exteriors. In fact, in many aspects, we are even superior. All men have the same emotions women do. The only difference is that women's emotions are not subdued. We are woman enough to show our emotions. To say we are unstable or weak for this is a silly notion. To think we are incapable of success in physics, math, and business is an abomination. To say we are inferior to sciences is a lazy generalization. Have you ever stopped to consider the misleading processes of acculturation? From this myth, we decree our emancipation. And no, we won't aspire to society's deceptive, aggressive, discriminative, maladaptive expectations. We are women, such beautiful, compassionate creatures. And I assure your looks are not your most beautiful features. You are not a number on the scale. You are not delicate. You are not frail. You are not here for the entertainment of males. And from the cages of idealizations of beauty, we will prevail. Throughout history, women have been oppressed in countless ways. Daily struggles of objectification and discrimination we face every day. In relationships and with people, we are taught to please and obey. Well, we're here to let you know that these unreasonable demands are not okay. No, I'm not going to sugarcoat things. This is what I believe. From my experience and studies, this is what I've perceived. Worldwide rights for women is what we must strive to achieve. For the idea and notion of the submissive, passive woman, you shall grieve. Our opinion, intellect, and voice we shall not hide. For the respect of our thoughts and minds is what we strive. For the liberations of hands still tied. And no, this is not about picking sides. We acknowledge that we are equal, although we are different. But for our dissimilarity, we shall not suffer such cruel punishment. Our differences, although equivalent, are there to complement the strengths and weaknesses of men, which formulates congruence. Womanhood is something we must celebrate. It is a woman's mind and heart we should appreciate. And disrespect and inequality we shall not tolerate. Our strength and power you better not underestimate. And no, we are not jealous of your penis.
Narges Kestu. Thank you very much. Very, very important.
Thank you.
Now we're going to listen to two segments about the oppression of women under this system, taken from a talk by Bob Avakian called Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution.
The oppression of women and oppressive gender relations. Not only is white supremacy completely interwoven and tightly stitched together with the development of capitalism in this country, but male supremacy is also completely interwoven and tightly stitched together with the whole historical development of the division between exploiters and exploited, oppressors and oppressed throughout the world, including the capitalist imperialist system, which is dominant in the world today. Thousands of years ago, with the development of human societies in such a way that means of production, land, domesticated animals, tools, and so on, were no longer the common resource of people, but instead became privately owned. And with the division of labor resulting in women being responsible for child rearing, and men dominating ownership of these means of production and wanting to pass this along to their male heirs and not someone else's. This led to the dominance of the patriarchal family, with the man having power over his wife or wives and children, and women in society overall being subordinate to men, with all the brutality and terror, both mental and physical, that has been used to enforce this, and the whole ideology and culture of male supremacy and misogyny, regarding women as lesser, despised beings whose essential purpose is to serve men, that has rationalized and reinforced this inequality and oppression. This patriarchal oppression has also been bound up with the suppression and punishment of relations among people, including intimate relations, that run counter to and challenge traditional gender relations. It is crucial that there be determined struggle against this terrible oppression in all of its manifestations. But in order to finally abolish and move beyond all this, in society as a whole, and not just in one country, but for all of humanity, it is necessary to abolish the private ownership of the means of production, converting them into the common property of the people as a whole, and to replace the traditional patriarchal family with relations among people, including intimate relations, that are freely entered into and freed from all vestiges of oppression. This, of course, is impossible under capitalism. Only through the revolution to overthrow this system and uproot all relations of exploitation and oppression that are embodied in this system will it be possible to finally end the fundamental division in which half of humanity is subordinated to and dominated by the other half, and all the brutality and agony bound up with that. This is why, in the new socialist society that will be brought into being with the overthrow of capitalism, the goal, as set forth in the Constitution for the new socialist republic in North America, must be to overcome all traditions' chains embodied in traditional gender roles and divisions, and all the oppressive relations bound up with this in every sphere of society, and to enable women as fully as men to take part in and contribute to every aspect of the struggle to transform society and the world in order to uproot and abolish all relations of oppression and exploitation and emancipate humanity as a whole.
I had three before, now I reduced it to two. So the first one is in relation to the oppression of women and the material basis for why it cannot be resolved under the system. And you know, you said that to abolish oppression of women, you need to abolish the private ownership of the means of production. And I understand you said that by referencing that oppression of women was, you know, emerged with the division of society in classes and you know, with the development of private appropriation. So that's a fact, you know, that's a fact. But right now, you know, like what we see right now with oppression of women is that it has taken all different kinds of forms, and it is very confusing for me to think about, you know, like how is it that private ownership of the means of production define that women must be oppressed? So I have a hard time like wrapping my head around that.
Well, let me see. How many hours do we... Oh, no, this is a big question. That's what, you know, I look, the point is, if you want to talk about getting rid of the oppression of women, one of the things that you have to do is get rid of the whole family as it exists under capitalism and patriarchy as it exists. For example, how is private property, and I don't mean toothbrushes, but I mean wealth, how is that passed on from one generation to the next? It's not put into a common pool and then everybody draws from it, not under this system. It comes down through the family. So, you know, if you were trying to get rid of a system
with all these vast disparities of wealth and so on, you couldn't maintain a system where the wealth was privately owned and then passed down through the family, because then you would just be perpetuating the system of exploitation and the inequalities that go along with it. So you would have to you'd have to get rid of the whole thing where wealth and the family are, you know, completely bound together. And the wealth becomes social wealth, which goes to people according to their needs and is enlarged by people contributing according to their abilities. That's the goal you want to get to. So if you kept capitalism, if you're going to keep capitalism, then you would have to keep the family, the structure whereby things are consumed through the family. That, you know, like the capitalists and the religious fundamentalists are always telling us that the family is the basic unit of capitalism, at least many of them are. And it's true, if you think about how do people live, I mean, there are a lot of variations now. Some people don't, you know, some people aren't married, some people don't have kids, some people have kids and are not married. They're all different kind of variations. But in one form or another, the main way that people actually live and survive is through some kind of unit where, and let's remember, you have to raise future generations. So you have to have, the kids can't do for themselves when they're 2 months or 2 years old or 8 years old. So you have to have some sort of, under this system, you have to have some sort of system, some sort of unit through which that happens. And that happens through some kind of a family unit. Not all of them are headed by males the way they used to be. They're all kinds of different relations. But still, the traditional family still is the dominant institution in terms of what largely exists, even with all these changes. And if you look at the world as a whole, that's definitely true. Because this is a, let's keep in mind, we sometimes look only through the prism of what's right around us or just this country. This is a highly parasitic country. Another way to say that is it's the very high end of the food chain. You know, we're, you know, I saw recently a statistic that of all the people who work producing things, production workers in the world, 80% are in the third world, if you include China. So, you know, a lot of what we ends up on our, you know, plate or in our closet and our houses is made by people in all different parts of the world. And most of them are living in situations of the traditional patriarchal family. You know, so you, sometimes you can get things skewed just looking at what exists right around you in this country. But even here, if you, you know, there's still the unit where, you know, wealth and the ability to live comes through the family. And if you were going to keep the system of capitalism, you would have to keep that family. If you, you know, if you try to imagine passing on wealth through some other means under capitalism than doing it by inheritance and through the family. So then you got the question, well, can you have equality in the family under capitalism? If you're going to keep the family, can you get rid of the oppression of women in the family? Well, okay, first of all, again, there's the whole world. But then also within, just within this country, so let's even just leave aside the rest of the world, but which we can't, but just for the moment. Even within this country, okay, in order to have, in a society which has the whole patriarchal tradition and, you know, the patriarchy has been, as I said, you know, woven into the fabric of this society, in order to have no inequality, even within the family, you'd have to mandate that from the government. First of all, you'd have to say everybody has to enter into some kind of relation that makes up a family. And because we'd have to have some way that we're going to have inheritance and all the rest of it. All right, then you'd have to have the government under capitalism if you're going to get rid of inequality within the family, where the women are not the ones who are doing most of the family work, even if they also have a job. You'd have to have the government come in and actually supervise that. What about all the people who aren't in families? Are you gonna make all of them get into families? This leads you to Handmaid's Tale. type of stuff. The government also all of a sudden is mandating that everybody has to be in some kind of familial relationship. Even if it's an updated version, you could have gay marriages and trans marriages and all kinds, but everybody has to be involved in some kind of family, and it all has to be equal. You can't have a division of labor that's unequal. Well, that means that you'd have to mean that everybody had a job that allowed them to be equal in the family. Because if some people had to work more than other people or at lower wages or so on, then one would become dependent on the other. Just, you know, why do a lot of women, for example, stay in these relationships where they're battered all the time? Even raped by their husband. Just let's just say battered all the time. Well, partly it's, you know, they become convinced, you know, because of the culture, they become internalized their own oppression and become convinced that they must have done something wrong. But a lot of it is financial coercion. You know, that they may have kids. How am I and my kids going to survive? This guy is a terrible, you know, he's a terrible tyrant, but he brings in the money that we need to live on. If I break away from him, how am I going to live? So, you know, and this is a very common problem. You know, so how would you eliminate the dependence where one person, is everybody going to have under capitalism the same job where they have the same finances so that neither one would need to be dependent on the other financially? If you start going down the road with this, you can see how it's totally unworkable under capitalism. You have to get beyond all that sort of thing in order to have a situation where women would not be in the inferior position, given the whole way things have historically evolved. Now, you know, you can get islands of things in the professions and so on, where women can carve out a position of not being necessarily, but they still, you know, necessarily on the downside of an unequal relationship, or have no relationship at all with a man, can do that. But they're still living in a larger society and culture. I mean, look at the culture out here with regard to women. How can a woman really be equal and free of all the different expressions of oppression in a society like this one with this culture? You know, where, I mean, a tremendous amount of the pornography and strip club culture and all that is exactly in response to a section of women getting a certain amount of independence and position where they're not so dependent upon men. And so this is a way of reinstituting that, you know, it's not completely abolished, but, you know, it's a way of concentrating that subordinate position in a very grotesque way. Well, you may not be able to, you know, I saw a thing where a guy went to a strip club, and he was talking about how for $20 he could get this woman to strip. And he said, that gives me a real good sense of power, that for $20 I can make this happen. Well, think about that. You know, so this is what you're dealing with in the culture at large. So once you start really walking this through, you can see it's impossible. You'd have to transform the whole economy. You'd have to transform all the historically evolved relations between the genders with all the different variations to get rid of all of, like I said, all vestiges of oppression. And you have to thoroughly transform the culture. You know, and under capitalism, again, if you walk through it, just can't be done. You cannot. The reason it comes back ultimately to you were asking, why is it a question of the, you know, private ownership, the means of production? Why is it the mode of production? Why is it the economic system that's ultimately involved? Because of what I was walking through, there are many other manifestations and forms, very real forms of the oppression of women that are not reducible to economic relations. And you have to go after all that. That's why I say you got to transform the culture, you got to transform all these social relations. But if you don't have an economy that allows you to do those things, then you're not going to be able to do it. No matter, you may be able to, like I said, fight and win certain reforms, but then, you know, they're only going to be partial and they're always going to be under attack. So you have to go after all these different dimensions of the oppression of all different people who are oppressed. But then you also have to transform the foundation of society, the economic system and the economic relations, in order to have the basis to really carry that through. As I said in the New Communism, you have to have a mode of production that doesn't prevent you from doing that, and which, on the contrary, actually fosters and facilitates that, makes it more possible to do that. So that's the relationship between all these different manifestations and the underlying economic system, or sometimes called the mode of production.
All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Dr. John and Revolution. Talk to you again next week.
Let's all just pray on it right now.